Mr. Robertson, please introduce the next item.
Okay, we're in the home stretch here. So this is this item provides the board with an update on our relatively new cannabis regulation unit at this regional board, and check in on how we're implementing the new statewide general order. The last update brought to the board was in January of 2017, so it's almost been 2 years. The Cannabis Regulatory Program Manager, Arwin Wyatt-Mehrer, putting a new hat on, different hat on, I'll say, will provide a presentation discussing the Central Coast Water Board staff's efforts in enrollment and implementation of the cannabis regulation strategy. Arwin will also share several photos providing the board with a whiff of what staff have been encountering during these inspections.
And also with a background that we attended WQCC and there was an extensive cannabis presentation covering State Board, CDFA, DPR.
Multi-programmatic
yeah.
approach. And just as a caveat, I want to say that there is no program in this regional board that has more jokes associated with what they're regulating than this program, hence my whiff reference.
Well, why don't you lead off by sharing the jokes? I mean, let's have a little fun.
Yeah, why don't you start on a high note?
And I thought, did you say that we were going to get a whiff of what was in the program?
I did, yeah.
Maybe you need a snack first.
Arwin, with your new hat, if you're too green in all of this discussion, it's okay.
Okay, let's not get down to the weeds, so please proceed.
Okay. Good morning, or I guess good afternoon now. My name is Arwin Wyatt-Mehrer. I'm the Cannabis Regulatory Program Manager, and as John Robertson mentioned, I will be providing you with an update on our program. So a quick outline for today, I'll provide an enrollment update. We'll also talk about some of the requirements specific to this order and the challenges that we're facing trying to implement a statewide order, a brand new statewide order here in Region 3, and then we'll go through some inspection photos. So a little bit of background. This is a statewide general order. It was adopted in October of 2017, so we've been implementing this for a little over a year now. This created programs in all the regions statewide, and it requires close coordination with the Division of Water Quality up at State Board, the Division of Water Rights, and other regional boards. The order does include significant water rights requirements and components. We don't implement those pieces, but we do work closely with water rights to make sure that all of those requirements are being followed. And in terms of other regions, we have a good roundtable going, and Regions 1 and Regions 5 actually have had cannabis programs, had their own orders for a few years prior to the State Board order, so they have a little more experience with this, and they have slightly more developed programs a couple years on us. So we work with them to get ideas and improve our program. State Board is also currently updating the general order. The comment period just ended at the end of November, and they are targeting February of next year for when they will actually adopt those updates. And so this is a pretty quick turnaround from an October order adoption to performing updates. That's in part because legalization was coming fast and the State Board, they knew that this was going to be a somewhat imperfect order, but they needed to get something in place. And so they knew that they would be going back and updating it periodically. This update occurred a little sooner than they had even originally intended, but so they're making their way through these updates and then they will continue to relook at it. As we implement our program more, we will continue to be involved and make sure that the updates that they're making make sense for our region as well. Okay, so enrollment numbers. One thing about this order is that it includes both a waiver component and a WDR, or waste discharge requirements, component. And so sites that are a permanent structure with an impermeable floor, they enroll in the waiver. Sites that are outdoors, maybe in hoop houses, or are in a greenhouse with a dirt floor or a permeable floor, they go into the waste discharge requirement side. And so here's, I'll talk about this table a little bit, and I'll talk about times when we might need to consider individual waste discharge requirements for a site. So as I mentioned, we have the waiver. About a third of our current enrollments are in the waiver. And then we have the waste discharge requirement side, which includes this tier one and tier two. The tiers are based on the size of the operation. If it's less than an acre, it's tier one. If it's greater than an acre, it's tier two. And then the order also includes these risk designations, which are based on the slope or the riparian setback. So for an operation to be low risk, no part of the operation can be located on greater than 30% slope, and no part of the operation can be occurring within the riparian setback. And I'll be talking about those setbacks a little more throughout this presentation. Moderate risk sites are those sites where the slope is between 30 and 50%, or any part of the site is on a slope between 30 and 50%. And they are outside of the riparian setback. High risk are sites where any portion of the site, that's the cultivation area, or if they're storing equipment, storing materials, anything like that, any cannabis-related activities are located within the riparian setback, then they go into this high-risk category. So this individual WDR piece comes into play for those sites that might have greater than 50% slope. They are not covered by this general order, which is seeking to provide coverage and require monitoring and reporting from the majority of sites throughout the state. Those sites were considered to be more extreme than the sites that are covered by the general order, so we would consider individual waste discharge requirements. They might need additional controls in place and additional monitoring and reporting. Another time when we might consider individual WDRs is for a site that is high risk and is, so they are operating within the setback, we could consider, rather than requiring them to get out of the setback and comply with the order, we could consider giving them individual waste discharge requirements. And we'll be assessing all of that as we continue to receive enrollments and understand the sites. Some quick statistics here. We have currently about 1,200 total cultivation acres enrolled. This is actually only in the waste discharge requirement side. The waiver side, they don't report their acreage. That is something that we're talking to State Board to change, because we think that's something that we need to be aware of. But just to give you a general sense, 1,200 cultivation acres so far. The largest sites, I think that's interesting, we have a 300-acre site that enrolled recently in Santa Maria, and then we also have 70 and 85-acre sites in Lompoc. Regions 1 and 5, they don't have sites that compare to this. Their largest sites right now are maybe 10 acres, and we're looking at a 300-acre site, which is a significant amount of cannabis.
Arwin, do you have an average?
The average is low. I think the average for our region was maybe 2 acres. We have a lot of small sites. As you can see, tier one sites, that's about a fifth of our sites, so those ones are less than 1 acre. And then we do have a lot of sites that are in the 1 acre range. So we don't have a whole lot of sites that are big like these ones, but I expect that we'll start seeing more of them, and I expect that average might creep up. So a little more information about these high-risk sites. And so those are sites where any portion of their operation is located within the riparian setback. Right now, based on our enrollment information, we have 5 sites that are enrolled as high-risk. However, as we've been going out and performing inspections and verifying enrollment information with operators, we've been confirming that many sites are actually incorrectly enrolled. Maybe they didn't understand what was meant by the setback, or they didn't go out and actually measure the distance and confirm that, yes, some of their operation is occurring within the setback. So far, 18 have been confirmed through inspections. We've also been performing analyses in-house to predict where we think there might be additional sites that we should inspect. Yes?
Quick question. The table that you're showing in your presentation appears to be an updated version of Table 2 in the report. Is that true?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, we sent out many, many notices of applicability shortly after drafting this report, so I wanted to include that update. There was a big December 1st deadline for licenses with the Department of Food and Ag, so that resulted in us receiving a lot more applications, a lot more payments, and issuing a lot of NOAs. A little bit of some of the reporting requirements. These are based on the tier and the risk. These include the site management plan, which is kind of akin to the farm plan in the irrigated lands regulatory program. The nitrogen management plan, which applies to a subset of tier two cultivation sites. And this is where they describe to us how they predict they will be fertilizing their crops, irrigating their crops, storing and handling their fertilizer containing materials. We have the site erosion sediment control plan for moderate risk sites. They have a higher risk related to sedimentation and erosion, so they need additional planning. And then the disturbed area stabilization plan is for high risk sites only. And this is basically their plan for how they will comply with the riparian setbacks, meaning no longer operate within those setbacks, and how they will stabilize that area, including revegetate it if needed. So we're working through some of those. It also includes an annual reporting requirement. We'll be receiving our first round of reports this coming March. And that's where they would report out on any changes to their operation, how they're, if they have the nitrogen management plan component, that's when they report out on what they actually applied. The plans are their prediction, and then they report on what they actually did in the previous year.
Just quickly, site management plans are required by all permittees?
All that are in the WDR side.
In the WDR side, okay.
Yeah. So the order also requires implementation of best practicable treatment or control, BPTC. It includes, there's an attachment A to the order that lists out many, many expectations, many requirements that the cultivators must comply with, requirements related to sediment erosion control, winterization, water usage requirements that, again, we're not enforcing on those ones, but we are coordinating with water rights on those ones. So it lists out many requirements that they must follow. The order also includes a 401 water quality certification aspect, and this is for activities associated with the order. For example, if a site needs to do some work in the stream as part of complying with the riparian setbacks, this 401 piece is built into this order. And so we have not received any of those yet. We expect to receive one soon, and then we'll have to work through that process, coordinate with our 401 unit to make sure that we are being consistent with their requirements. So we'll work through that as we start receiving those. And then again, the order does prohibit cultivation and related activities within the riparian setbacks. And I'll talk about that a little more on the next slide. So this map, if we look down at the bottom right, we see that we're in Monterey County. And then this is Quail Creek watershed. So the blue line running across the bottom of the map is Quail Creek, and that light blue buffer is the approximate, based on GIS, 100-foot setback from Quail Creek. When staff is out there on the inspection, they do actual measurements using a tape measure, so they're confirming the actual setback width. It will be different than what we see in a GIS map.
And Arwin, how are you running the setback? Is it from the middle of the creek, or is it from the edge of the creek?
It's from the edge of the creek. the top of the incised channel.
And that changes, doesn't it, year to year, depending on flow?
It can. I think the order goes back to, it's based on the previous 2 years is how. And to some extent, for some water bodies, it's going to be easier to do the measurement, and some it's going to be more complicated. So staff's working through that in the field. These red parcel lines, that shows the parcels. I believe there are 3 operations enrolled on these 2 parcels. These dots that you see are, we have soil storage, trash, unstabilized ground, and bare dirt. So these were GPS points that staff took while out in the field. They also took photographs at all those sites, and that's included in our inspection report. And as you can see, many of those soil storage, trash, unstabilized ground, and bare dirt locations are within that setback distance. So we notified this cultivator that they need to be enrolled as tier 2 high risk and that they need to comply with the setback requirements. We also see that some of the cultivation area is within the setbacks a little bit. So they'll need to figure out as part of their disturbed area stabilization plan how they're going to basically get out of the setbacks and comply with those requirements. So again, no cultivation or related activities are permitted within that setback. If they are currently operating in the setback, they are assigned high risk designation and they need to create a plan for how they're going to comply with those requirements.
So just a quick question on the required disturbed area stabilization plan. So that'll require introduction of new biomass and restoration of those creek areas?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it can. Okay. So priority watersheds. This is an approach that all of the regions statewide are taking, and this is how we are working to focus our outreach, our enrollment, and focus our inspections within watershed areas. So we basically, each region selects 3 to 5 watersheds that we'll focus on for the next year or couple years, depending on the size of the watershed or the region's priorities, and we'll focus our efforts in those areas. So these priority watersheds are selected considering criteria including beneficial uses, habitat, impairment, such as if the water body is on our 303D list, the expected density of cannabis sites. So for us, in our region right now, we're still kind of trying to figure out exactly where these cannabis hotspots will be showing up. And so we'll continue to reprioritize our watersheds as needed as we start seeing cannabis popping up in a high density in other locations. And we also work closely with Department of Fish and Wildlife when we are determining our priority watersheds, because we do go out, they come out on inspections with us, they invite us out on inspections, so we want to be on the same page as we're implementing these requirements. And we actually are in the process right now of reassessing our priority watersheds for 2019. These are our 2018 priority watersheds that we have been focusing on. So we have Alisal Creek and Quail Creek in Monterey County and Carpinteria Creek down in Santa Barbara County. And so as part of this priority watershed process, we sent out watershed letters. These went not only to the cannabis cultivation sites, but to neighboring sites. We tried to blanket the watershed, get the word out that the water board is there, we will be there performing inspections. If you're growing cannabis, you're required to enroll with us. You're required to get a water right if you need to get a water right. And that CDFW requirements also apply. If you need a lake and stream bed alteration agreement, then you need to go and get that. So these were designed to really get the word out. They were not targeting the cannabis sites. They were just mass mailings. We also then held workshops in Salinas and in Carpinteria, where we partnered with other agencies, Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Food and Ag, local counties, cities, local industry groups, to talk about all of the regulations that are required of these growers, all the various agencies that they need to be working with, and to help them understand the process and meet the people who they'll be working with to get their permits.
Arwin, were there any federal agencies like United States Fish and Wildlife Service participating?
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think we had federal agencies at these. Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. And so we've also been focusing our inspections on within these watersheds. So in Alisal Creek, so far we've inspected 9 out of the 26 cannabis sites that we are aware of in that area, and we're continuing to work our way up to inspecting at least 50% of the cannabis sites. Quail Creek, we've inspected 16 of the 18 sites, so we're pretty much wrapped up there. And then down in Carpinteria, we're almost at 50% of the sites. So we'll be wrapping up these priority watersheds and moving on to additional priority watersheds. Not that we'll leave these ones behind, but we'll just focus our efforts in new places to try and increase enrollment and increase awareness. So a little more about inspections. In total, we've performed 57 inspections region-wide. So on the previous side, that was 41 just in priority watersheds. And we also have performed additional inspections in other watershed areas. I just want to acknowledge my team who's sitting here and who've been sitting here all morning waiting for this item, who have performed these 57 inspections in 2018 alone. So we have Leah Lemoyne, James Bishop, and Alyssa Bucci. And that's a lot of inspections for a pretty small team. And I think that's a testament to their dedication and determination on getting out there, getting the word out, and making sure that people are aware of and complying with the requirements.
So Arwen, how do they team up? Do all three go to every one, or do they go solo?
We don't go solo. Cannabis is still a little bit of an iffy topic in a lot of areas. They typically go in pairs. If there is going to be another agency there, if state board is going to be there, something like that, then one of them might go out, but typically in pairs.
Thank you.
Yeah. On these inspections, we coordinate closely, as I mentioned, with Department of Fish and Wildlife, other law enforcement, CAL FIRE, district attorneys, sheriffs. Sometimes they invite us out to get the water board, water quality perspective. Sometimes we're asking them to come out and give maybe the Department of Fish and Wildlife perspective. Some of the common issues that we're seeing during these inspections include, as I've talked about, activity within the riparian setback and an associated incorrect risk designation. And so we are working with those people who we've identified as being enrolled incorrectly to fix their enrollment. We are also seeing inadequate sediment and erosion control, and this order really includes a lot of requirements related to that, so we're addressing those. We're seeing improper chemical storage, sometimes within the riparian setback. Leaky or faulty irrigation or fertigation plumbing. And so when you're out there, you can take a nitrate quick test and really quickly show, hey, this leak is really high in nitrate. You need to do something about this. It's leaking right onto the soil. That can cause problems. And then we're also seeing a lot of these sites with reverse osmosis systems and associated discharge and discharge of the associated brine. And so we're trying to work through that. The order does not directly regulate these reverse osmosis discharges, so we're trying to figure out the right regulatory mechanism for those.
Are those RO discharges related to the cannabis cultivation, or are they just related to people living on the properties?
Well, the ones that we've been seeing on the inspections are related to the cannabis cultivation. Okay. So what people will do, what we've been hearing, is they will RO the water before they even use it on their plant, so they'll basically clean it out, and then they will put in whatever fertilizers they want to get it at the levels that they're looking for, and then they'll apply it, and then you have this reverse osmosis discharge. So sometimes they might be ROing pretty high quality water, and the discharge is also pretty high quality. Sometimes they might be ROing lower quality water, and so you can have more impacts, potential impacts from that discharge.
Have the cultivators been fairly amenable
responsive
during
these inspections?
I think so. I think they have. Right now, I think because cannabis is so new to being legal, and these are the people who are really trying to figure out all these various permitting processes, these are the ones, right now at least, who are going to be more willing to comply. They're just trying to understand, tell me what I need to do, and I'll figure out how to do it.
Arwin, onto what medium are they discharging? Creek, land, soil?
We've seen all of that right now. They should not be discharging directly to the creek, clearly. And if they are discharging to land, which we have seen, then they really need an additional permit, some sort of a waiver or some additional permitting. And so we're working through what should that permitting look like.
So my question, Arwin, in what is the sense? This is just a curiosity question. What is your sense, the staff's observations? How many of these growers are already experienced growers versus with experience in broader ag, you know, producing row crop or other kinds of food production, versus those that are simply coming out of the woods, so to speak, as cannabis growers, where they may not have best practices experience at or minimal, mostly directed to their own kind of instincts and not coming out of regulatory experience like are those that are the farmers that are transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, for example, in areas down in like Carpinteria, we're seeing a lot of conversion. People were growing cut flowers, now they're growing cannabis. So they have quite a bit of experience with growing plants at least and varying levels of experience with being regulated by us. Some of them may have been enrolled in the ILRP, and we are seeing a lot of that converting from ILRP enrollment over to cannabis enrollment. Others, for example, up in the more backwoodsy areas, they were likely illegal sites before, and they are working on getting legal now that it is legal. I don't have a good sense of the proportion of those, of how many were previous growers and are now, or still growers, but cannabis growers now.
Yeah, because I think there would be a difference in the kind of support and technical assistance that that latter category would require, because coming out of the shadows, so to speak, they have very little familiarity with what's required to operate an agricultural operation.
And I think for some who are coming from irrigated lands regulatory program into this one, they have some idea of what it's like to be regulated by the water board, but these are also very different requirements that they're now having to sort through. And, you know, they report things through different portals and in different ways, and we're requiring different pieces of information. So it is an adjustment even for them.
Yeah, I was going to say that pest application requirements are extremely strict, because it's an issue because the threshold of detectable pesticide is so low that other agricultural commodities who may be across the street are becoming increasingly concerned of potential drift cross-contamination, which, if it was a like crop across the street, wouldn't be an issue. But because of, if you have these detectable levels at very low level, the whole crop has to be destroyed. So there is increasing concerns over the liability of having cross-contamination just by drift from application of a leafy green crop, say, across the street. So, so the, you know, the level of requirements, yeah, it is farming, but it's a whole different game.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, I know that the, so the counties, I see up there, you know, coordinating with the DAs and the sheriffs and I guess the county permitting offices, and our relationships with the different counties are sometimes up and sometimes down because we regulate them too. How is that going? How are we doing at really establishing collegial working relationships with the sheriffs and the DAs and the county permitting agencies?
I'd say it does vary county to county, area to area. Some DAs, for example, are much more boots on the ground, out in the field than others. Monterey, we've had a lot of activity, a lot of co-inspections with them. Other counties, less so. Even with local law enforcement, like sheriffs, in some counties, like I believe Santa Cruz County, they're kind of taking a bit of a hands-off approach, didn't want to accompany on the inspections. For CDFW, Department of Fish and Wildlife, they have their regional jurisdictions are different from ours, and so for them it depends somewhat on their resources that they can allocate. So some have a little more resources. The ones that are in the northern part of our region, Santa Cruz area, they have a lot going on, so they have less resources available. But I'd say we have a great working relationship with the CDFW's scientific staff and permitting staff. They're really helpful to us in the cannabis programs statewide. We coordinate really closely with them, and we work with them. We have to check with them before we go out on any inspection to make sure that there aren't any active investigations or anything like that going on. And they're very responsive. They're very helpful. So I'd say overall it's positive, and we're continuing to work on those relationships more. Yeah. Okay, so next I'll walk through some photos from various inspections. So this is in the San Ynez watershed in Santa Barbara County. And over on the left, we see some hoop houses. And on the right, what kind of looks like a road here. This actually is the water body, was the water body before it was diverted. So they back, well, you can't really see it in this picture, but there's a person standing back there, and there's actually a little culvert right next to them. And so they installed culverts to divert the stream around their hoop house. So when we went out there, we said, that's not really in compliance with the order, so you need to work on that.
Mimicking natural
watershed. Yeah.
You don't have a photograph of that?
Of
that culvert?
Here's another culvert on the site.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is the same site. Here's another culvert. You can see that here's the water body of the creek, and this culvert was washed out. These don't look that great. This is the same site over on the left. This was during our first inspection, and you can see they had hoop houses. This is within the setback area, and then on the second inspection, if you could see it a little better, I'm not sure why it looks so bad. All the photographs look the same on the computer, so I don't know.
Arwin, you mentioned it's within the setback. Do you distinguish between being in the setback and being in, like, the creek bed? Or is the creek bed included in the setback?
It's included in the setback, yeah. So basically, if you're in the creek, if you're in the setback, either way, you're out of compliance with the order, and you need to get out of there.
Well, there are folks in Santa Barbara County, though, that are cultivating in creeks. There's berry hoops in creeks now, so.
Yeah.
And it's a different group of cultivators.
But is that compliant?
With the county right now, there's a lot of people that are cultivating grow crops.
In the creek bed, yeah. And that's compliant with the policies?
Bed. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't know.
In existing policy, yeah. There's a whole separate ordinance that's going on in Santa Barbara County, but it's a whole different group of cultivators from your regular row croppers.
Yeah, and the ag order does not address that. The cannabis order does. So we have added authority here through the cannabis order for cannabis operations.
So under the ag order, you can compliantly grow in the creek bed?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, in the right photograph, the hoop houses have been removed, and if you could see the photo a little better, you can see that some of the natural vegetation is returning.
So what's the rationale behind that? Is it just the way the two programs have evolved over time with different types of constituents?
You know, I think it's largely, I think it's in part because the cannabis order is based largely off of Region 1 and Region 5's cannabis orders, and Region 1 deals with this a lot. They have different types of creeks, different types of water bodies, and agriculture is different up there, so they were able to, in their cannabis order, adopt these setback requirements. I think it's also, to some extent, because cannabis growers have been less organized so far, and so they don't have the same kind of lobbying power, honestly.
So I'm going to add to that. Also, cannabis is coming out of prohibition. You know, by and large, the growing of cannabis is coming out of a prohibition period. So it's easier to define the universe of regulation for them. Farming has been around for 10,000 years in California. It predates most of the regulation. And so it's way harder to regulate it. You know, for some of the reasons that Arwin just mentioned, they're much more organized.
Right. I did understand that. I was just asking the question to kind of get it out on the table, but then it begs the question. Ultimately, we're concerned about threats to water quality. So should we treat one entity or culture different than the other?
The rationale isn't founded in science.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess at some point in time, are we going to try to harmonize these?
Yeah, maybe 8.0.
So I don't want to get off of the cannabis discussion and into a 4.0 discussion here, because that would be not on our agenda.
Don't let the attorney do this to you.
Yeah. Okay.
Arwin, is that photo on the left, is that where the staff got their Jeep stuck in the creek?
That's not our Jeep. We don't have a Jeep. That's where they got their Jeep stuck in the creek. Okay, here's another site. This is Tassajara Creek Watershed in San Luis Obispo County. So we see more hoop houses down on the right. The water body is just to the right of those hoop houses. These boxes on the left were, I believe, planter boxes that they were planning to plant cannabis plants in. I think they have since nixed that idea. So what we see here is, again, hoop houses in the setback, and we see this steep slope coming off of those planter boxes with inadequate erosion control measures. So staff advise them to work on that at this site. This here is Quail Creek in Monterey County. And what we see, so the trees that you can sort of see in the background, that is Quail Creek. And so we have spent growing media and piles of soil that are located within the Quail Creek setback area. And so they have a high potential to discharge to the creek. So again, staff let them know that they need to comply with the setback requirements. They can't store the soil, and you see plastic pots over on the left-hand side. They need to remove that from the setback area and comply with the requirements. Couple more pictures at Quail Creek. Over on the left, this was a greenhouse that they had deconstructed, and they were storing the trash in the setback. Over on the right, this is a makeshift retaining wall that had been created also within the setback. So again, staff advised them they need to clean up the site.
Arwin, some of these in creek or in setback operations that you visited and told them what they need to do, did that put any of them out of business, or were they all able to adjust outside the setback?
So I'd say some are still working on getting out of the setback. Getting out can be easier if it's just, you know, remove this pile of dirt if you have a greenhouse that's located within the setback and you might need to deconstruct something, or we need to figure out another regulatory pathway for you, that would take longer. I don't think we've had any terminations, none that we know of, based on complying with the setback requirements.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. How much time are you giving them to remove a structure like a hoop house out of a setback?
So what the order says is they basically have until the onset of the next winter period to get out, and if they can't, then they need to, because maybe it's a more permanent structure or something like that, then they need to propose to us their timeline for how they will get out. Maybe they get an extra year or 2 years, but that's what the order says.
Do they have to do anything in the interim to protect erosion or?
So there are the BPTC requirements for erosion control and winterization do still apply. They still need to be making sure that they're not caught, they're not discharging to the creeks, not causing any water quality issues, and they would report out on that in their annual report. So this is more of Quail Creek, and this is a common practice that staff have been seeing throughout the region. So we have these greenhouses, and the cultivator has dug out ditches around the greenhouse to accommodate stormwater flows. They really have inadequate erosion control measures here, though, because there's going to be a large volume of water when it rains coming off of those roofs of the greenhouses, and this is not the best way to manage that volume of water. So staff advised them to work with a qualified professional and to get adequate sediment and erosion control measures in place. All the previous sites that I've been showing you are legal in the sense that they are working on, they're enrolled with us, they're enrolled with the county, they're working through all their permitting issues. They might have some compliance areas that we're working on with them, but they're legal sites. I wanted to show just a kind of another end, some of the extreme sites that we've been seeing. This is in Scott Creek watershed in Santa Cruz County, and this site and a few other sites up in this area were just, there was large amounts of trash and human waste at these sites. And so this is an area where we're really relying on county code to step up and handle these sites. They are illegal sites. They cannot enroll with us because they're not enrolled with the county. You know, these are not legal sites, but there are threats to water quality here, and some of them we are working with the county to address through their permitting authority. Surface water diversions. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I just wanted to mention this because this is something that we're seeing out in the field. This is where water rights staff come in and they help out. Over on the left, this is a site in San Luis Obispo County with a diversion. On the right is that Santa Cruz location and illegal diversion. And so water rights has a lot to say about these, and they help out in these areas.
Those two pictures are just typical examples of what was going on for decades, right?
Yes.
Just wild land, illegal grows.
Yes. And that is why the order includes all these water rights, this water rights component, because coming into legality out of kind of the hills and the mountains, a lot of those sites have been having these illegal diversions, and we want to make sure that they're not causing negative impacts to stream flows and things like that. So. And then reverse osmosis, we already touched on this. This is an issue that we are, as a program, looking at. Again, the cannabis order does not regulate or permit these RO discharges. And so what we're doing is we're assessing, especially in high density areas such as Carpinteria, we're trying to assess how many of these systems are we talking about, what's the volume of discharge, what's in the discharge, how should we be permitting them. We're trying to look at it from a cumulative impact point of view as well. And so we're working through that, and we're working with the waste discharge requirement WDR unit to find the best path forward for these sites. And then my last inspection photo slide, I just wanted to show at least one slide with some good BMPs. This is a slide, a photograph taken at a site where they are capturing all of their tailwater. So you can't really see it, but they have the plants in these planters, and they have these buckets underneath the planters that capture all of the tailwater. They then recycle that tailwater. They mix it with they chlorinate it and mix it with their reverse osmosis water and reuse it. And so this is a good BMP in action. They're reducing their water usage. They're preventing water from discharging onto the soil or anything like that.
Is the chlorination of the reused water required?
I don't think that it's required. It's probably just a good idea from there. I don't know if it's required for
other
purposes.
So if it's not required, they do it anyway. Is it to reduce pests, pestilent
and
load?
Disease, probably. Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, a greenhouse, though, would still have the concern for stormwater coming off the structure. It's impervious. And so are they just as diligent in complying with that requirement, the stormwater component?
For this specific site?
Well, I mean, in general, you're saying that there's a lot of greenhouse operations that mm-hmm. are practicing, you know, similar BMPs, mm-hmm. you know, doing good things. Are they also paying attention to the potential stormwater impact from the impervious structure itself?
I'd say right now some are and some aren't. Like what we saw in a previous photo where they're digging out those ditches around the greenhouse, that would be an example of an area where they really need to improve. Other sites probably do have it under control.
You know, just kind of as an aside, but it does relate to that picture that you're showing, that you showed a couple of slides ago. In Santa Barbara, the city, talking about its stormwater permit, they are requiring it's either tier two or tier three properties that you have to, a solution to treating stormwater is to take a trench like that and line it with rock so that the water is flowing across the rock and getting purified before it exits the property. And that just seemed to be like a perfect example of what they could do to solve that problem. What's that?
Yeah, well, slow it down.
Yeah, slow it down, but it's, you know, it's making it go over and under a rock and
right.
aerating it.
It oxygenates it.
Oxygenated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got one right around the corner from where I live. Mm-hmm. New parcel mm-hmm. is developing itself, and stormwater is coming down, mm-hmm. and they have rock-lined the bottom part of the property. Mm-hmm. And the city has said, hey, we don't care about the flow coming out mm-hmm. and the water. You've got to... It's got to go to the street, mm-hmm. but before it hits the street, it's got to be cleaned mm-hmm. on site.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they could probably accomplish that in a very easy, simplistic mm-hmm. way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see what the qualified professionals that we've been advising them that they need to work with, yeah. we'll see what they say and what they install.
Yeah.
Okay, so next steps for the program as we continue to move forward. We will continue to work to increase our enrollment numbers, including performing outreach and education workshops. We'll continue to coordinate with other agencies and issue directives to enroll in our order as needed. We have issued about 100 of those so far, and we're working through that process. We'll continue our successful inspection program into next year in our priority watershed areas and in other areas as needed. We will reassess our priority watersheds for the 2019 year, or for 2019, and we will continue to help cultivators understand and comply with the riparian setback requirements. That's really a big part of this order, and it's going to be one of the more challenging aspects of this order for some sites. And as discussed, we will continue to assess the reverse osmosis discharge impacts and find the best permitting path forward for those. So that's all I have. if you have any additional questions.
On my left.
Yeah, I don't want to give preference to visiting cannabis inspection sites, but would there be a chance for board, you know, we go on field trips now and then, would there be a chance for board members to tag along on inspections, whether it be a cannabis inspection site or any other kind of inspection site, underground tank or any other thing? But I haven't accompanied staff on any inspection sites. So whether it be cannabis or any other inspection site, I think going on an occasional tag along would help me if there's particularly ones, you know, when they come up in the next year or two in northern Monterey County. So it'd be easier for me to tag along. I don't know if other board members are interested, but I would like to attend.
So I'm going to ask a specific question of you that's going to indicate, I know your line of work. Do you receive health and safety training associated with your line of work?
Yeah, we get a lot of that.
Yeah,
we have
that's
health
what
and
I
safety
figured.
Plans and
yeah, right,
tailgate
right.
And sessions,
regular
PPE and all that
kind of slip, trip, and fall safety safety training.
It's mostly common sense.
Some of the right, that's absolutely true. Some of the inspections that we do demand a certain level of health and safety training, regular training. Others, I think we can probably work without that. You know, we could go select the sites such that they're fine. Yeah.
And Mayor Dale Gallo should, I'm sure he knows, no sampling.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I'm sorry you have to put up with this.
Hey.
Well, we know you love plants. I mean, Mr. Delgado, so it would just be natural for you to appreciate the different varieties that are being grown in across the Central Coast region.
I wouldn't do anything that was illegal.
It's legal.
Well, it's legal now.
Yeah. You don't even have to deny that you never inhaled. So anyway, I thought we need a little levity after this, but you know, I think you're doing great job, great work. Yeah. And what is different about what you're doing, this is new. You know, it's one thing to take over a division and something that has been done for years and you have a legacy of information available. You don't. So a lot of it is kind of, as you go learning the process, same thing as you alluded to, state board. You know, it's work in progress. So I think, you know, great job there. And
I had another question, I'm sorry. You're in the sort of the business now, are there statewide, region-wide, are there too many cannabis cultivation sites? Do you expect that there will be more or less in the future?
I don't know that I can answer whether there are too many sites. I think I predict that there will be more in our region in the future, or at least more that come into being legal. I know that we still have many sites that are illegal sites, and various law enforcement agencies are working on shutting those sites down to kind of make room for the legal sites who are going through the expensive permitting process and all that, so they want to help them compete with the illegal sites. I do expect that we will see more sites in the future, though.
The reason I ask is that I've read in the media that there's more permits issued than the demand for the cultivated product, and so the expectation may be that there would be fewer surviving that competition. I thought maybe you'd had some.
There's probably a bit of a bubble coming up. That's what I would expect as cannabis continues down its path of legality. I expect that a lot of sites they're working on being legal, and it's very expensive to be legal, and then everybody's wanting to jump in and get in the market now. I think we'll probably see the market get overloaded, and then we'll see a retraction in the number of sites, and then I think it'll increase out. I know I've heard from row crop growers, regular growers, that they are going to wait a little while, see kind of what happens, and let the people who might have less experience farming or less experience farming out in the legal realm, sort through kind of the mess, and then they might expand their portfolios and convert some of their land that has been maybe broccoli or lettuce, convert some of that to cannabis.
All right, thanks.
All right, on my left, no more question. On my right, no more question. So kind of to follow up on Mayor Delgado's comment, I think it's not so, perhaps not as much folks who will go out of business, but the price point for the product is going to drop because of the increased competition. So then the, you know, the lucrative aspect of the business is going to change. The folks who, you know, didn't have good financial backbones certainly could struggle. But, you know, it's we see this in other ag commodities. You know, farmers are fantastic in creating their own oversupply where everybody rush. You know, we see this with wine grapes, you know, where you get thousands of acres planted and the price tank, then you move back. So you go back up in your price point. 5 years later, you do the same thing. So it becomes very cyclic. Anyways, you know, thank you. Appreciate. So thank you for bringing that item to us. And then we can move on to the last item of the day.
Okay, thank you. The last item is the
Oh, and I should have asked. No pub speaker card on this topic. Yeah. I see none. Sorry.
I'm sure.